Have you ever done something so humiliating, so utterly embarrassing, that when you think back to that moment in time, it makes you cringe in your heart still? You just kind of feel like your stomach turn when you think back to that moment. I'm sure all of us have at least a few cringeworthy moments in our lives, right? For me, one that I can really remember was back when I was in middle school. In fact, the first day of middle school. Now, I need to let you all know, I was a rather geeky kind of kid. Can you imagine? So let me, you can't imagine, I see. Okay. So let me paint the picture. Here I was, slicked back, gelled hair. I mean, I put the LA looks on there like there was no tomorrow. I bought it by the pallet load. I had an X-Men t-shirt. And was wearing sweatpants, but not the cool kind that, you know, the athletic kids wear. I'm talking Hanes and Fruit of the Loom. It was not a good look, okay? So I was a pretty geeky kid, and I was really shocked when this beautiful eighth grade girl, whose locker was just next to mine, decided to strike up a conversation and introduce herself. Now, in all fairness, she was not coming on to me or anything like that. She was just being kind to a very shy, timid sixth grader. But what you need to know is I was instantly in love with Liz Thorntonstocks, okay? I mean, this girl just hung the moon for me. Unfortunately, she was so overwhelmingly beautiful that my brain couldn't take it all at once, and it decided to just completely shut down. It was as if it said, okay, this is enough emotion for one day. I need to take a breather. We're going to reboot. I'll be back with you in a minute. Which is fine, I was very happy listening to Liz, but she wanted to have a conversation. So things got a little awkward when she said, well, tell me, what's your name? 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 Yes, I have one of those. In fact, I think it begins with a letter, A, B, C. It starts with C, but what do they call me? My mind literally just went blank at the moment. The very moment I needed to remember my name, I couldn't think of Chase. So I did what any rational sixth grade boy who just found himself deeply madly in love would do. I made one up. Whatever name that came to the top of my head was the name I was going to pick. And for whatever reason, that name was Craig. Now, I don't know why Craig. There's nothing wrong with the name Craig. For all you Craigs out there, you got good names. Maybe I chose it because I start with a C. It starts with a C. There's an A in there. I have an A. I don't know. The only thing I know is it was the first thing that came in my head, and now in hindsight, I do wish if I was going to come up with this alias, I would have come up with a cooler alias. Like, how cool would it have been if I was like, the name is Blaze Campbell. No, I'm Craig now, and so when my mind finally came to and I realized what had happened, I was so utterly embarrassed. And now what I should have done is in that moment admitted, you know, I'm a complete goober. My name's Chase. I don't know why I said Craig, but I couldn't do that. I thought to myself, no way, Craig Campbell. You are way in too deep now. You are Craig Campbell to Liz Thorntonstocks as long as she lives, which isn't so bad, right? She's in eighth grade. I was in sixth. How often would I see her? I only have to deal with this for 1 year. I'll just be Craig for Liz, and we'll see each other at our lockers. Not a big deal. How often could we see each other? Here's how often. As it turns out, she had a younger sister, Cora. And Cora and I would then spend almost every single class together for the next 6 years. All the way to high school, Cora Thorntonstocks and I were in class together. So Cora is calling me Chase, her sister's calling me Craig, and eventually the whole story leaks and Cora catches on. It's because I'm madly, deeply in love with her sister, and she never let me down. In fact, when we were graduating high school, Liz was there to see us, and Cora reached over to her sister, put her arm around her, said, hey, Craig, Liz is here. Liz is here. So I still cringe every time I think back to that story. Do you have a story like that? Maybe not where you're so ridiculous that you make up a name, but a cringeworthy story. You know, when I think back to those times, even though I try not to think back to them, I realize that usually at the heart of the problem, usually the culprit is pride. And if it's not the culprit, it at least exacerbates the situation. That's what happened with Liz. Pride wasn't the problem, but pride certainly exacerbated my problem. It didn't allow me to admit my humility and own my embarrassment. And so I just dug in deeper and deeper. This morning, Jesus is talking to us in Luke chapter 14 about humility and hubris. Simply put, Jesus tells us that the key to avoiding humiliation is to live a life, ironically, of humility. He then kind of goes on to explain that humility is the path of discipleship, that if we're going to follow him, we're going to follow a humble path. And it's also the means by which we live out our calling as disciples. Now, if you're like me, you kind of got to admit humility can be a hard virtue to exercise. For one thing, the minute we think we got a handle on humility, that's usually the point that we need to begin to realize that we don't got a grip on it at all. One of my kids, one of their favorite movies is the Marvel Guardians of the Galaxy, and there's this character, Drax, who in one scene goes, "I too am exceedingly humble." That's the problem with humility. The minute we think we got a hang of things, we start to realize pride has already started to seep back into our hearts. Another reason why we struggle with humility is because of all the Christian virtues, humility really seems to strike against our sinful nature. Now, I've heard it argued that pride is the root of all sin. Now, I'm not sure if I completely agree with that, but I certainly agree that it's the oldest of sins. And so I get the point. And so that tells us that humility would be one of the most challenging Christian virtues for us to embrace. Yet Jesus, over and over again, instructed us as his followers that we're to be marked by humility. In fact, next to love, humility is the most commended trait that Jesus taught his disciples over and over again. Now, if you're thinking, it must have been really easy for the disciples to embrace humility. Certainly God had instructed them in the Old Testament to live out humility. Then you would be wrong. Because as much as we see throughout the Old Testament that God commended his people to be a people of humility, the reality is, in the practical daily Jewish life, humility was not something that they valued. It was not something that they prized. In many ways, they had embraced their Gentile neighbors' culture of honor and shame. They were an honor-shame society. So what that meant is you worked your tail off to gain as much honor as possible, and shame was to be avoided at all cost. We're not so put off by shame. Shame, it's not great, but for Jewish and Gentile culture in the first century, shame was horrible. It was about the worst thing that could happen to a person. And so this idea of humility would have been rather scandalous for Jesus' disciples. It would have been scandalous for Luke's original audience to read. To say that disciples of Jesus are to be marked by humility would have been just as scandalous back then as it is for us today. So if you have your Bibles, I want to encourage you to turn to Luke chapter 14. We're going to be primarily parked in verses 7 through 14. Now, as you're turning to Luke chapter 14, let me set the stage for you. We're told in verse 1 that Jesus had been invited to a dinner party by one of the prominent Pharisees. We're also told that this Pharisee had ulterior motives. He wasn't all about hospitality, but he was actually inviting Jesus for hostility. You see, he and the other Pharisees were looking for Jesus to say something or do something that they could then use against him. They didn't like Jesus at this point, and so they wanted to catch him in his words or catch him in his actions and prove that he isn't the Messiah, that he wasn't the person that people thought he was. And so I share all that to tell you that when Jesus told this parable about where to sit at the table, there was already a lot of tension in the air. There was already a lot of friction between Jesus and the men he tells this parable to. Now, we see there in verse 7 that the reason why he told this parable is that he began to notice that the men were doing something that they probably did quite often, and that is that they would look for a place to sit that had significance and honor. In that culture, sitting next to the host was a place of honor and was to be prized. You see, in Jesus' day, much like ours, society was built upon a hierarchy, okay? The only difference was in that social hierarchy, there wasn't much upward movement. You could go down the ladder, but it was really hard to go up. And so a lot of people who were born as lower class or as slaves died as lower class or slaves. And people who were privileged or were upper class were more valued, and they had more rights. So their lives were held in higher esteem. And so if you are a person who is a person of privilege and esteem, you're going to do everything in your power to protect that. You're going to do everything to hold on to your honor and everything to push out any shame that comes your way. An example of this is found in the Apostle Paul, right? In the book of Acts, we're told that Paul was a Roman citizen. And that tells us two things. First, his family was a family of means. They were, at minimum, an upper middle class family. Secondly, as a Roman class citizen, he had special rights and privileges. He was valued in society at a higher level. And so the men around this table were looking to sit closest to the host, this prominent Pharisee. And they were kind of fighting and pushing their way to kind of get there. But we don't do that today, do we? None of us, we never fight to sit next to the important people in life, do we? Believe it or not, this happened to me one time. So back in 2020, when the world was locked down in COVID, I had this young couple come to see me. This girl's parents were members of our church. She went to a non-denominational church. It was a huge church. And he was Eastern Orthodox. Well, neither church was open, and so they weren't allowed to get married in their churches. And so they came to me, the Anglican. I'm you know, kind of look Orthodox enough and sound hip enough that I guess I was a good merger of both worlds. And they said, "Would you marry us?" So I said, "Absolutely, let's go through the marriage counseling process, and then we'll do this wedding." He was a chef, and she was an events coordinator, and so they had this fantastic wedding in their backyard. It was a lot of fun, but when I showed up, I realized I wasn't just at some regular wedding. What I didn't know at the time was Pano Keratosis, the groom, was a world-famous chef. Now, some of us probably never heard of Pano, but if you're a foodie, you've probably seen him on the Food Network. He's cooked alongside Gordon Ramsay. He's been on Iron Chef and all that and won. He's got cookbooks. His family has three of the most prominent restaurants in Atlanta. So this guy is, you know, inviting the who's who of Atlanta. And where did Father Chase get to sit? Next to Brother Pano and Sister Pano and his best friend. And I'm sitting at this really cool table and I'm just loving every moment of it. It's by far the best meal I've ever had. And I enjoyed life. But it got even cooler the next day or the next week when I went to Rotary. Now, at Rotary, I was just the young little clergy kid joining this club. What's this guy doing here? But when he had posted all those Instagram pictures with me as the clergy, suddenly I was invited to the big kids' table. "Oh, Father, come sit with us." And I liked it. I could resonate with the Pharisees at that moment. All that to say, we still do this today. We all still fight for that seat of prominence, to gain honor. But when Jesus saw this happening with the Pharisees, he saw it for what it was: pride. Pride in their heart. The Pharisees valued reputation over character, success over substance, and privilege over real honor. It was more important to them to sit at the right place than to live in God's calling on their life. In fact, pride was preventing them from living out God's calling in their lives. You see, what Jesus points out to us in this parable is that the Pharisees, they would only invite guests who would bless them, who would give them more success, that would increase their name in the public eye. And guests, on their part, they would only attend the house of someone who would improve their social status, would be a blessing upon them. But what Jesus shows at this dinner, and if we actually read just before this little passage, we'll see this in a fuller picture. Jesus actually shows the Pharisees, he's saying to them, "Guys, you've already been blessed by the best dinner host. You are God's covenantal people. The problem is you're taking that blessing you received and you're holding it to yourself. You're wanting to receive more and more blessings. But God bless you to be a blessing. They were blessed to be a blessing." Now, I know that sounds like some cheap Hobby Lobby, you know, Christian decor. You can go tomorrow, get yourself some rustic-looking wood with some cursive written on it. Blessed to be a blessing, but it's true. God had blessed the Pharisees to be a blessing to others, but pride was keeping them from living out that calling. They were hoarding it for themselves. That's why Jesus says in verse 12 and 13, he says, "But you, when you give a dinner or a banquet, don't invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or your rich neighbor, lest they also invite you in return and you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the cripple, the lame, and the blind. And you will be blessed, because they cannot repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the just. Pride was getting in the way of their purpose, of God's calling on their life. And Jesus is warning here in this parable that their pride was going to lead to humiliation. And remember, that's not like humiliation for us. That's not like Chase saying he's Craig in front of the beautiful Liz Thorntonstocks. This is shame. This is detrimental. This is awful. One of the worst things that can happen to them. Well, guess what? That same sin, that same pride still can take hold of us today. If there's one thing that is a barrier for us as Western Christians to living into our calling, I think it would be our pride, our egos, our self-centeredness. In the book Renovation of the Heart by Dallas Willard, he talks about how modern humanity lives in a rage of moral self-righteousness. And he explains that the further we get away from the person and the message of Jesus, the more the spirit of superiority and of moral distancing and condemnation marks the way we think and act. Not the mark of humility, but the mark of moral distancing, superiority. We can't live into the life that God has called us to live, or live into the mission that he has set before us, if we let pride take hold of our hearts. You know, what's interesting to me about this parable is the way that Jesus taught it, is that it spoke to both the individual and to the community. It spoke to the individual and to the whole. It's Jesus' way of saying pride usually starts with us as individuals, but pride never stays in just one heart. No, it's like an infectious disease. So if I come to this church with pride filled in my heart, it never just affects Father Chase. It's always going to affect you all. And your pride is always going to affect us. And so what Jesus is telling us through all of this is pride starts with each and every one of our hearts. We all have a responsibility to root out the pride. But collectively, we also, as a community, have an obligation to make sure we are not a community marked with pride, self-centeredness, or having an ego. Otherwise, just like the Pharisees, pride is going to get in the way of our purpose. So what do we do if we find ourselves wrestling with pride? Well, Jesus has one word for us. Humility. Humility. Verse 11, he says, "For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." Proverbs 16 tells us that pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before the fall. Jesus tells us that we can avoid that by embracing humility. The Greek word for humble means to be made low or to be under. And for us, it means to be under God, under his power. But being under his power is not some sort of oppression or suppression. No, Jesus says that when we live under God, under his power, what we're doing is we're making space for God to move in and through our lives. Being under God actually allows us to be lifted up to God instead of us trying to lift ourselves up. What Jesus is telling us is that there is great power in humility, just as much as there is great destruction with pride. You know, one of my favorite stories about humility is told by a guy named Chan Gailey. Some of you might remember Chan Gailey. He was the former coach for Georgia Tech back in the early 2000s. Well, before he was the head coach of Georgia Tech, he was actually the coach of a smaller university called Troy University. It was a little Division II school. And Chan had this dream of going on one day, hopefully, to the NFL or a major university. And so he worked really hard to turn this Division II school around. And so they had this one year that was a phenomenal year. They were just going gangbusters. And so, you know, he was determined that they would stay on this winning streak. So he's working his boys really hard. Well, one day during training, his secretary said, "Hey, Chan, you have a phone call. It's Sports Illustrated." He said, "Tell them I'll be right there." So Chan kind of gets himself ready. He's thinking, what's this about? Is, Am I going to be on the front cover of Sports Illustrated? Are they going to write a major article about me? Is this going to be my big break? I've worked really hard. I kind of deserve this. And so he cleared his throat and he picked up the phone and he said, "Hello?" And the other man on the line said, "Is this Chan Gailey?" Well, yes, it is. "Hi, Chan. This is Bill from Sports Illustrated. How are you doing?" "Oh, I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?" "Good. I just wanted to let you know, your subscription to Sports Illustrated is about to expire, and if you act now, you can have a discounted rate." Chan, who told the story, ended it by saying, "In life, you are either humble or you will be humbled. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." Friends, we are invited into a life of humility, into a life that Jesus himself modeled. Humility was the Jesus way and the heart of Jesus' ministry. And he invites us to make that our heart as well. Humility is not about self-deprecation. It's not about convincing ourselves that we're incompetent. It's not about beating ourselves up or looking down upon ourselves. At the core of humility is submission. If we want to live a life of humility, then it starts by putting Jesus on the throne of our hearts. It starts by making him the center of our lives and living under his authority. I like how C.S. Lewis put it. He says, "Humility is not about thinking less of ourselves. It's about thinking of ourselves less." The Pharisees could never bring themselves to embrace the life of humility to which Jesus called them. And so while they had been immensely blessed by God, they never really took hold of their blessing, and they never lived into their calling. Quite frankly, we too can miss our calling if we let pride take hold of our hearts, if we don't let Jesus be at the center of our lives. And the warning here in Luke 14 is that when hubris, not humility, has control of our hearts, then we're not just robbing ourselves, but we're robbing the very people we've been called to bless. We have been blessed to be a blessing to others, but we can't do that if pride has hold of our heart. Jesus tells us hubris always leads us to humiliation, but ironically, humility will lead us to exaltation. So the word for the day is humble. May all of us discover the true blessing and the life-giving transformative power of humility, and may all of us find Jesus at the center of our hearts. Amen.